So now the connection to crafts becomes obvious. Crafts are just the practical application of metis.
I associate the word crafts with making crappy belts and ashtrays in summer camp, Randy says. I mean, who wants to be the fucking goddess of macrame?
It's all bad translation. The word that we use today to mean the same thing is really technology.
Okay, now we're getting somewhere.
Instead of calling Athena the goddess of war, wisdom, and macrame, then we should say war and technology. And here again we have the problem of an overlap with the jurisdiction of Ares, who's supposed to be the god of war. And let's just say that Ares is a complete asshole. His personal aides are fear and terror and sometimes strife. He is constantly at odds with Athena, even though, maybe because, they are nominally the god and goddess of the same thing, war. Heracles, who is one of Athena's human protégés, physically wounds Ares on two occasions, and even strips him of his weapons at one point. You see, the fascinating thing about Ares is that he's completely incompetent. He's chained up by a couple of giants and imprisoned in a bronze vessel for 13 months. He's wounded by one of Odysseus's drinking buddies during the Iliad. Athena knocks him out with a rock at one point. When he's not making a complete idiot of himself in battle, he's screwing every human female he can get his hands on, and, get this, his sons are all what we would today call serial killers. And so it seems very clear to me that Ares really was a god of war, as such an entity would be recognized by people who were involved in wars all the time, and had a really clear idea of just how stupid and ugly wars are. Whereas Athena is famous for being the backer of Odysseus, who, let's not forget, is the guy who comes up with the idea for the Trojan horse. Athena guides both Odysseus and Heracles through their struggles, and although both of these guys are excellent fighters, they win most of their battles through cunning or, less pejoratively, metis. And although both of them engage in violence pretty freely, Odysseus likes to call himself sacker of cities, it's clear they are being held up in opposition to the kind of mindless, raging violence associated with Ares and his offspring. Heracles even personally rids the world of a few of Ares' psychopathic sons. I mean, the records aren't totally clear. It's not like you can go to the Thebes County Courthouse and look up the death certificates on these guys, but it appears that Heracles, backed up by Athena all the way, personally murders at least half of the Hannibal Lecterish offspring of Ares. So, insofar as Athena is a goddess of war, what really do we mean by that? Note that her most famous weapon is not her sword, but her shield, Aegis. And Aegis has a Gorgon's head on it, so that anyone who attacks her is in serious danger of being turned to stone. She's always described as being calm and majestic, neither of which adjectives anyone ever applied to Ares.
I don't know, Enoch. Defensive versus offensive war, maybe?
The distinction is overrated. Remember when I said that Athena got lake-fucked by Hephaestus?
It generated a clear internal representation in my mind.
As a myth should. Athena Hephaestus is sort of an interesting coupling in that he is another technology god. Metals, metallurgy, and fire were his specialties. The old-fashioned rust belt stuff. So, no wonder Athena gave him a hard-on. After he ejaculated on Athena's thigh, she's all, "Ew," and she wipes it off and throws the rag on the ground, where it somehow combines with the earth and generates Erichthonius. You know who Erichthonius was?
No.
One of the first kings of Athens. You know what he was famous for?
Tell me.
Invented the chariot, and introduced the use of silver as a currency.
Oh, Jesus.
Randy clamps his head between his hands and makes moaning noises, only for a little while.
Now, in many other mythologies, you can find gods that have parallels with Athena. The Sumerians had Enki, the Norse had Loki, Loki was an inventor god, but psychologically he had more in common with Ares. He was not only the god of technology, but the god of evil, too, the closest thing they had to the devil. Native Americans had tricksters, creatures full of cunning like coyote and raven in their mythologies, but they didn't have technology yet, and so they hadn't coupled the trickster with crafts to generate this hybrid technologist god.
Okay, Randy says. So obviously where you're going with this is that there must be some universal pattern of events that, when filtered through the sensory apparatus and the neural rigs of primitive superstitious people, always gives rise to internal mental representations that they identify as gods, heroes, etc.
Yes. And these can be recognized across cultures in the same way that two persons with root reps in their mind might recognize me by comparing notes.
So, Enoch, you want me to believe that these gods, which aren't really gods, but it's a nice concise word, all share certain things in common precisely because the external reality that generated them is consistent and universal across cultures.
That is right. And in the case of trickster gods, the pattern is that cunning people tend to attain power that uncunning people don't. And all cultures are fascinated by this. Some of them, like many Native Americans, basically admire it, but never couple it with technological development. Others, like the Norse, hate it and identify it with the devil.
Hence the strange love-hate relationship that Americans have with hackers.
That's right.
Hackers are always complaining that journalists cast them as bad guys, but you think that this ambivalence is deeper-seated.
In some cultures, the Vikings, to judge from their mythology, would instinctively hate hackers. But something different happened with the Greeks. The Greeks liked their geeks. That's how we get Athena.
I'll buy that. But where does the war goddess thing come in?
Let's face it, Randy. We've all known guys like Ares. The pattern of human behavior that caused the internal mental representation known as Ares to appear in the minds of the ancient Greeks is very much with us today, in the form of terrorists, serial killers, riots, pogroms, and aggressive tin-horn dictators who turn out to be military incompetents. And yet, for all their stupidity and incompetence, people like that can conquer and control large chunks of the world if they are not resisted.
You must meet my friend Avi.
Who is going to fight them off, Randy?
I'm afraid you're going to say, we are.
Sometimes it might be other Ares worshippers, as when Iran and Iraq went to war and no one cared who won. But if Ares worshippers aren't going to end up running the whole world, someone needs to do violence to them. This isn't very nice, but it's a fact. Civilization requires an aegis, and the only way to fight the bastards off in the end is through intelligence, cunning, metis.
Tactical cunning like Odysseus and the Trojan horse,
or both that and technological cunning. From time to time, there is a battle that is out and out won by a new technology, like longbows at Crecy. For most of history, those battles happen only every few centuries. You have the chariot, the compound bow, gunpowder, ironclad ships, and so on. But something happens around, say, the time that the Monitor, which the Northerners believed to be the only ironclad warship on Earth, just happens to run into the Merrimack, of which the Southerners believe exactly the same thing, and they pound the hell out of each other for hours and hours. That's as good a point as any to identify as the moment when a spectacular rise in military technology takes off. It's the elbow in the exponential curve. Now it takes the world's essentially conservative military establishments a few decades to really comprehend what has happened. But by the time we're in the thick of the Second World War, it's accepted by everyone who doesn't have his head completely up his ass that the war is going to be won by whichever side has the best technology. So, on the German side alone, we've got rockets, jet aircraft, nerve gas, wire-guided missiles. And on the Allied side, we've got three vast efforts that put basically every top-level hacker, nerd, and geek to work, the code-breaking thing, which, as you know, gave rise to the digital computer, the Manhattan Project, which gave us nuclear weapons, and the Radiation Lab, which gave us the modern electronics industry. Do you know why we won the Second World War, Randy?
I think you just told me.
Because we built better stuff than the Germans?
Isn't that what you said?
But why did we build better stuff, Randy?
I guess I'm not competent to answer, Enoch. I haven't studied that period well enough.
Well, the short answer is that we won because the Germans worshipped Ares and we worshipped Athena.
And am I supposed to gather that you or your organization had something to do with all that?
Oh, come now, Randy. Let's not allow this to degenerate into conspiracy theories.
Sorry, I'm tired.
So am I. Good night.
And then Enoch goes to sleep. Just like that. Randy doesn't. To the Cryptonomicon. Randy is mounting a known ciphertext attack, the hardest kind. He has the ciphertext, the Arethusa intercepts, and nothing else. He doesn't even know the algorithm that was used to encrypt them. In modern cryptanalysis, this is unusual. Normally, the algorithms are public knowledge. That is because algorithms that have been openly discussed and attacked within the academic community tend to be much stronger than the ones that have been kept secret. People who rely on keeping their algorithms secret are ruined as soon as that secret gets out. But Arethusa dates from World War II, when people were much less canny about such things. This would be a hell of a lot easier if Randy knew some of the plaintext that is encrypted within these messages. Of course, if he knew all of the plaintext, he wouldn't even need to decrypt them. Breaking Arethusa in that case would be an academic exercise. There is a compromise between the two extremes of, on the one hand, not knowing any of the plaintext at all, and, on the other, knowing all of it. In the Cryptonomicon, that falls under the heading of cribs. A crib is an educated guess as to what words or phrases might be present in the message. For example, if you were decrypting German messages from World War II, you might guess that the plaintext included the phrase Heil Hitler or Sieg Heil. You might pick out a sequence of 10 characters at random and say, let's assume that this represented Heil Hitler. If that is the case, then what would it imply about the remainder of the message? Randy's not expecting to find any Heil Hitlers in the Arethusa messages, but there might be other predictable words. He's been making a list of cribs in his head. Manila, certainly. Waterhouse, perhaps. And now he's thinking gold and bullion. So, in the case of Manila, he could pick out any 6-character string from the intercepts and say, what if these characters are the encrypted form of Manila? And then work from there. If he were working with an intercept only 6 characters long, then there would be only one such 6-character segment to choose from. A 7-character long message would give him 2 possibilities. It could be the first 6 or the last 6 characters. The upshot is that for a message intercept that is n characters long, the number of 6-character long segments is equal to n minus 5. In the case of a 105-character long intercept, he will have 100 different possible locations for the word Manila. Actually, 101, because it's of course possible, even likely, that Manila is not in there at all. But each of these 100 guesses has its own set of ramifications vis-a-vis all of the other characters in the message. What those ramifications are exactly depends on what assumptions Randy is making about the underlying algorithm. As far as that goes, the more he thinks about it, the more he believes he has some good stuff to go on, thanks to Enoch, who, in retrospect, has been feeding him some useful clues when not spamming him through the bars with theogonical analysis. Enoch mentioned that when the NSA started attacking what later turned out to be the fake Arethusa intercepts, they were going on the assumption that they were somehow related to another cryptosystem dubbed Azure. And sure enough, Randy learns from the Cryptonomicon that Azure was an oddball system used by both the Nipponese and the Germans that employed a mathematical algorithm to generate a different one-time pad every day. This is awfully vague, but it helps Randy rule out a lot. He knows, for example, that Arethusa isn't a rotor system like Enigma. And he knows that if he can find 2 messages that were sent on the same day, they will probably use the same one-time pad. What kind of mathematical algorithm was used? The contents of Grandpa's trunk provide clues. He remembers the photograph of Grandpa with Turing and von Heckelhaber at Princeton, where all three of them were evidently fooling around with zeta functions. And in the trunk were several monographs on the same subject. And the Cryptonomicon states that zeta functions are even today being used in cryptography as sequence generators, which is to say, machines for spitting out series of pseudo-random numbers, which is exactly what a one-time pad is. Everything points to that Azure and Arethusa are siblings and that both are just implementations of zeta functions. The big thing standing in his way right now is that he doesn't have any textbooks on zeta functions sitting around his jail cell. The contents of Grandpa's trunk would be an excellent resource, but they are currently stored in a room in Chester's house. But on the other hand, Chester's rich and he wants to help. Randy calls for a guard and demands to see Attorney Alejandro. Enoch Root goes very still for a few moments and then shunts directly back into the loping, untroubled sleep of a man who is exactly where he wants to be. Slaves. People smell all kinds of ways before they have burned, but only one way afterwards. As the army boys lead Waterhouse down into the darkness, he sniffs cautiously, hoping he won't smell that smell. Mostly it smells like oil, diesel, hot steel, the brimstony tang of burnt rubber and exploded munitions. These smells are overpoweringly strong. He draws in a lungful of reek, blows it out. And that, of course, is when he catches a whiff of barbecue and knows that this concrete-coated island is, among other things, a crematorium. He is following the army boys down black smudged tunnels bored through a variegated matrix of concrete, masonry, and solid rock. The caves were there first, eaten into the stone by rain and waves, then enlarged and rationalized by Spaniards with chisels, jackhammers, blasting powder. Then along came the Americans with bricks, and finally the Nipponese with reinforced concrete. As they work their way into the maze, they pass down some tunnels that apparently acted like blowtorches. The walls have been scoured clean, as if a torrent had been running through it for a million years. Silver pools lie on the floor where guns or filing cabinets melted into puddles. Stored heat still radiates from the walls, adding to the heat of the Philippine climate, making all of them sweat even more, if that is possible. Other corridors, other rooms, were nothing more than backwaters in the river of fire. Looking into doorways, Waterhouse can see books that were charred but not consumed, blackened papers spilling from burst cabinets. "One moment," he says. His escort spins around just in time to see Waterhouse ducking through a low door into a tiny room where something has caught his eye. It's a heavy wooden cabinet, mostly transmuted into charcoal now, so it looks like the cabinet's gone, but its shadow persists. Someone has already pulled one of its doors off its hinges, allowing black confetti to flood into the room. The cabinet was filled with slips of paper, mostly burned now, but thrusting his hand into the ash heap, slowly, most of this place is still hot, Waterhouse pulls out a bundle, nearly intact. "What kind of money is that?" the army guy asks. Waterhouse pulls a bill from the top of the bundle. The top is printed in Japanese characters and bears an engraved picture of Tojo. He flips it over. The back is printed in English. £10. "Australian currency," Waterhouse says.
"Don't look Australian to me,"
the army guy says, glowering at Tojo. "Half the nips had won," Waterhouse says, and shrugs. He throws the stack of £10 notes onto the ash heap of history and carries his single copy out into the corridor. A necklace of light bulbs has been strung along the ceiling. The light glances off what looks like pools of quicksilver on the floor. The remains of guns, belt buckles, steel cabinets, and doorknobs melted down into puddles in the Holocaust, now congealed. The fine print on the bill says, "Imperial Reserve Bank, Manila."
Sir, you okay?
The army guy says. Waterhouse realizes he's been thinking for a while.
Carry on,
he says, and stuffs the bill in his pocket. He was thinking about whether it was okay to take some of this money with him. It's okay to take souvenirs, but not to loot. So he can take the money if it's worthless, but not if it is real money. Now, someone who was not so inclined to think and ponder everything to the nth degree would immediately see that the money was worthless because, after all, the Japanese did not take Australia and never will. So that money's just a souvenir, right? Probably right. The money is effectively worthless, but if Waterhouse were to find a real Australian £10 note and read the fine print, it would also probably bear the imprimatur of a reserve bank somewhere. Two pieces of paper, each claiming to be worth £10, each very official-looking, each bearing the name of a bank, one of them a worthless souvenir, and one legal tender for all debts, public and private. What gives? What it comes down to is that people trust the claims printed on one of those pieces of paper, but don't trust the other. They believe that you could take the real Australian note to a bank in Melbourne, slide it over the counter, and get silver or gold, or something at least, in exchange for it. Trust goes a long way, but at some point, if you're going to sponsor a stable currency, you must put up or shut up. Somewhere you have to actually have a shitload of gold in the basement. Around the time of the evacuation from Dunkirk, when the Brits were looking at an imminent invasion of their islands by the Germans, they took all of their gold reserves, loaded them on board some battleships and passenger liners, and escorted them across the Atlantic to banks in Toronto and Montreal. This would have enabled them to keep their currency afloat, even if the Germans had overrun London. But the Japanese have to play by the same rules as everyone else. Oh, sure, you can get a kind of submission from a conquered people by scaring the shit out of them. But it doesn't work very well to hold a knife to someone's throat and say, "I want you to believe that this piece of paper is worth £10 sterling. They might say that they believe it, but they won't really believe it. They won't act as if they believe it. And if they don't act that way, then there is no currency. Workers don't get paid. You can enslave them, but you still have to pay the slave drivers. The economy doesn't work. You can't extract the natural resources that prompted you to conquer the country in the first place. Basically, if you're going to run an economy, you have to have a currency. When someone walks into a bank with one of your notes, you have to be able to give them gold in exchange for it." The Nipponese are maniacs for planning things out. Waterhouse knows this. He has been reading their decrypted messages 12-18 hours a day for a couple of years now. He knows their minds. He knows, as surely as he knows how to play a D major scale, that the Nipponese must have given thought to this problem of backing their imperial currency, not just for Australia, but New Zealand, New Guinea, the Philippines, Hong Kong, China, Indochina, Korea, Manchuria. How much gold and silver would you need in order to convince that many human beings that your paper currency was actually worth something? Where would you put it? The escort takes him down a couple of levels and finally to a surprisingly large room deep down. If they are in the bowels of the island, then this must be the vermiform appendix or something. It is globe-shaped, walls smooth and ripply in most places, chisel-knod where men have seen fit to enlarge it. The walls are still cool, and so is the air. There are long tables in this room, and at least 3 dozen empty chairs. So Waterhouse nips in tiny whiffs of air at first, terrified that he will smell dead people. But he doesn't. It figures. They're in the center of the rock. There's only one way into the room. No way to get a good draft through this place. No blowtorch effect. No burning at all, apparently. This room was bypassed. The air is as thick as cold gravy. "Found 40 dead in this room," the escort says. "Dead of what? Asphyxiation? Officers?" "One Japanese captain. The rest were slaves." Before the war started, the term slave was to Lawrence Waterhouse as obsolete as Cooper or Chandler. Now that the Nazis and the Nipponese have revived the practice, he hears it all the time. War's weird. His eyes have been adjusting to the dim light ever since they stepped into the chamber. There's a single 25-watt bulb for the whole cavern, and the walls absorb nearly all of the light. He can see squarish things on the tables, one in front of each chair. When he first came in, he assumed that these were sheets of paper. Indeed, some of them are. But as his vision gets better, he can see that most of them are hollow frames sprinkled with abstract patterns of round dots. He fumbles for his flashlight and nails the switch. Mostly all it does is create a fuzzy yellow cone of oily smoke, swirling fatly and lazily in front of him. He steps forward, shooing the smoke out of his way, and bends over the table. It's an abacus, its beads still frozen in the middle of some calculation. 2 feet down the table is another, then another. He turns to face the army guy. What's the plural of abacus?
Beg pardon, sir?
Shall we say abaci?
Whatever you say, sir.
Were any of these abaci touched by any of your men? There is a flurry of discussion. The army guy has to confer with several enlisted men, dispatch gophers to interview people, and make a couple of phone calls. This is a good sign. There are a lot of men who would just say, no, sir, or whatever they thought Waterhouse wanted to hear, and then he would never know whether they were telling the truth. This guy seems to understand that it's important for Waterhouse to get an honest answer. Waterhouse walks up and down the rows of tables with his hands clasped carefully behind his back, looking at the abacai. Next to most of them is a sheet of paper or a whole notebook with a pencil handy. These are all covered with numbers. From place to place, he sees a Chinese character. "Did any of you see the bodies of these slaves?" he says to an enlisted man.
"Yes, sir. I helped carry them out."
"Did they look like Filipinos?"
"No, sir. They look like regular Asiatics."
"Chinese? Korean? Something like that?"
"Yes, sir."
After a few minutes, the answer comes back. No one will admit to having touched an abacus. This chamber was the last part of the fortress to be reached by Americans. The bodies of the slaves were mostly found piled up near the door. The body of the Nipponese officer was on the bottom of the pile. The door had been locked from the inside. It is a metal door and has a slightly outward bulge, as the fire upstairs apparently sucked all the air out of the room in a big hurry.
"Okay," Waterhouse says. "I am going to go upstairs and report back to Brisbane. I am personally going to take this room apart like an archaeologist. Make sure that nothing is touched, especially the abacai."
Arethusa. Attorney Alejandro comes to see Randy the next day, and they swap small talk about the weather and the Philippine Basketball Association, whilst exchanging handwritten slips of paper across the table. Randy gives his lawyer a note saying, "Give this note to Chester," and then another note asking Chester to go through that trunk and find any old documents on the subject of zeta functions and get them to Randy somehow. Attorney Alejandro gives Randy a somewhat defensive and yet self-congratulatory note, itemizing his recent efforts on Randy's behalf, which is probably meant to be encouraging, but which Randy finds to be unsettlingly vague. He had rather expected some specific results by this point. He reads it and looks askance at Attorney Alejandro, who grimaces and taps himself on the jaw, which is code for the dentist, and which Randy interprets to mean that said billionaire is interfering with whatever Attorney Alejandro is trying to accomplish. Randy hands Attorney Alejandro another note, saying, "Give this note to Avi," and then yet another note, asking Avi to find out whether General Wing is one of the Crips' clients. Then, nothing happens for a week. Since Randy lacks the information that he needs about zeta functions, he can't do any actual code-breaking work during this week, but he can lay the groundwork for the work he'll do later. The Cryptonomicon contains numerous hunks of C code, intended to perform certain basic cryptanalytical operations, but a lot of it is folk code, poorly written, and anyway needs to be translated into the more modern C++ language. So Randy does that. The Cryptonomicon also describes various algorithms that will probably come in handy, and Randy implements those in C++ too. It is scut work, but he has nothing else to do, and one of the good things about this particular kind of scut work is that it acquaints you with every little detail of the mathematics. If you don't understand the math, you can't write the code. As the days go by, his mind turns into some approximation of a cryptanalyst's. This transformation is indexed by the slow accretion of code in his code-breaking library. He and Enoch Root get into the habit of having conversations during and after their meals. Both of them seem to have rather involved inner lives that require lots of maintenance, and so the rest of the day they ignore each other. Anecdote by anecdote, Randy plots the trajectory of his life to date. Likewise, Enoch speaks vaguely of some wartime events, then about what it was like to live in post-war England, and then in the U.S. in the 50s. Apparently, he was a Catholic priest for a while, but got kicked out of the church for some reason. He doesn't say why, and Randy doesn't ask. After that, all is vague. He mentions that he began spending large amounts of time in the Philippines during the Vietnam War, which fits in with Randy's general hypothesis. If it's true that old man Comstock had U.S. troops combing the Philippine boondocks for the primary, then Enoch would have wanted to be around, to interfere or at least keep an eye on them. Enoch claims he's also been gadding about trying to bring internet stuff to China, but to Randy, this just sounds like a cover story for something else. It is hard not to get the idea that Enoch Root and General Wing may have other reasons to be pissed off at each other. Like, if I can just play Plato's advocate here, what do you mean exactly when you talk about defending civilization?
Oh, Randy, you know what I mean.
Yeah, but China is civilized, right? Has been for a while.
Yes.
So maybe you and General Wing are actually on the same team.
If the Chinese are so civilized, how come they never invent anything?
What, paper, gunpowder,
anything in the last millennium, I mean?
Beats me. What do you think, Enoch?
It's like the Germans in the Second World War.
Well, I know that all the bright lights fled Germany in the 30s, Einstein, Born,
and Schrödinger, and von Neumann, and others, but do you know why they fled?
Well, because they didn't like the Nazis, of course.
But do you know specifically why the Nazis didn't like them?
A lot of them were Jews.
It goes deeper than mere anti-Semitism. Hilbert, Russell, Whitehead, Gödel, all of them were involved in a monumental act of tearing mathematics down and beginning from scratch. But the Nazis believed that mathematics was a heroic science whose purpose was to reduce chaos to order, just as National Socialism was supposed to do in the political sphere.
Okay, Randy says. But what the Nazis didn't understand was that if you tore it down and rebuilt it, it was even more heroic than before.
Indeed. It led to a renaissance, Root says. Like in the 17th century when the Puritans tore everything to rubble and then slowly built it back up from scratch. Over and over again we see the pattern of the Titanomachia repeated. The old gods are thrown down, chaos returns, but out of the chaos the same patterns reemerge.
Okay, so again you were talking about civilization?
Ares always reemerges from the chaos. It will never go away. Athenian civilization defends itself from the forces of Ares with Metis, or technology. Technology is built on science. Science is like the alchemist's Ouroboros, continually eating its own tail. The process of science doesn't work unless young scientists have the freedom to attack and tear down old dogmas, to engage in an ongoing Titanomachia. Science flourishes where art and free speech flourish.
Sounds teleological, Enoch. Free countries get better science, hence superior military power, hence get to defend their freedoms. You're proclaiming a sort of manifest destiny here.
Well, someone's got to do it.
Aren't we beyond that sort of thing now?
I know you're just saying that to infuriate me. Sometimes, Randy, Ares gets chained up in a barrel for a few years, but he never goes away. The next time he emerges, Randy, the conflict is going to revolve around bio, micro, and nanotechnology. Who's going to win?
I don't know.
Are you not just a bit unsettled by not knowing?
Look, Enoch, I'm trying my best here. I really am. I'm broke, and I'm locked up in this fucking cage, all right?
Oh, stop whining.
What about you? Suppose you go back to your yam farm or whatever, and one day your shovel hits something that rings, and you suddenly dig up a few kilotons of gold. You'd invest it all in high-tech weapons?
Root, not surprisingly, has an answer.
The gold was stolen from all of Asia by the Nipponese, who intended to use it as backing for a currency that would become the legal tender of the Greater East Asia Co-Prosperity Sphere, and that while it goes without saying that those particular Nips were among the most egregious buttheads in planetary history, some aspects of their plan weren't such a shitty idea. That to the extent life still sucks for many Asians, things would get a lot better for a lot of people if the continent's economy could get jerked into the 21st or at least the 20th century, and hopefully stay there for a while instead of collapsing whenever some dictator's nephew in charge of a central bank loses control of his sphincters and wipes out a major currency. So maybe stabilizing the currency situation would be a good thing to accomplish with a shitload of gold, and that's the only moral thing to do with it anyway, considering whom it was stolen from. You can't just go out and spend it. Randy finds this answer appropriately sophisticated and Jesuitical and eerily in sync with what Avi has written into the latest edition of the Epiphyte II business plan. After a decent number of days has gone by, Enoch Root comes right back and asks Randy what he'd do with a few kilotons of gold, and Randy mentions the Holocaust Education and Avoidance Pod. Turns out that Enoch Root already knows about the heap, has already downloaded various revisions of it over the gleaming new communications network that Randy and the dentist strung through the islands, thinks it's right in line with his ideas vis-a-vis Athena, Aegis, etc., but has any number of difficult questions and trenchant criticisms. Shortly thereafter, Avi himself comes in for a visit, and says very little, but does let Randy know that, yes, General Wing is one of the Crips' clients. The grizzled Chinese gentleman who sat around the table with them in Kinakuta, and whose mugs were secretly captured by the pinhole camera on Randy's laptop, are among Wing's chief lieutenants. Avi also lets him know that the legal pressure has eased. The dentist has suddenly reined in Andrew Loeb and allowed any number of legal deadlines to be extended. The fact that Avi says nothing at all about the sunken submarine would seem to imply that the salvage operation is going well. Or at least going. Randy's still processing these pieces of news when he receives a visit from none other than the dentist himself.
"I assume that you think I had you framed," says Dr. Hubert Kepler.
He and Randy are alone in a room together, but Randy is conscious of many aides, bodyguards, lawyers, and furies or harpies or whatever just on the other side of the nearest door. The dentist seems ever so slightly amused, but Randy gradually collects that he is actually quite serious. The dentist's upper lip is permanently arched, or shorter than it ought to be, or both, with the result that his glacier-white incisors are always slightly exposed, and depending on how the light is hitting his face, he looks either vaguely beaverish, or else as if he's none too effectively fighting back a sneering grin. Even a gentle soul like Randy cannot gaze upon such a face without thinking how much better it would look with the application of some knuckles. From the perfection of Hubert Kepler's dentition, it is possible to infer that he had a sheltered upbringing, full-time bodyguards from the time his adult teeth erupted from the gum line, or that his choice of careers was motivated by a very personal interest in reconstructive oral surgery.
"And I know that you're probably not going to believe me, but I'm here to say that I had nothing to do with what happened at the airport."
The dentist now stops and gazes at Randy for a while, by no means one of those guys who feels any need to nervously fill in gaps in conversation. And so it is during the ensuing lengthy pause that Randy figures out that the dentist isn't grinning at all, that his face is simply in its state of natural repose. Randy shudders a bit just to think of what it must be like to never be able to lose this alternatively beaverish and sneering look, for your lover to gaze on you while you're sleeping and see this. Of course, if the stories are to be believed, Victoria Vigo has her own ways of exacting retribution, and so maybe Hubert Kepler really is suffering the abuse and humiliation that his face seems to be asking for. Randy heaves a little sigh when he thinks of this, sensing some trace of cosmic symmetry revealed. Kepler is certainly correct in saying that Randy is not inclined to believe a single word he says. The only way for Kepler to gain any credibility is for him to show up in person at this jail and utter the words face to face, which, given all of the other things that he could be doing, for fun or profit or both, at this moment, gives a lot of weight to what he's saying. It is implicit that if the dentist wanted to lie, badly and baldly, to Randy, he could send his lawyers around to do it for him, or just send him a fucking telegram for that matter. So either he's telling the truth, or else he's lying, but it's very important to him that Randy should believe in his lies. Randy cannot work out why on earth the dentist should give a flying fuck whether Randy believes in his lies or not, which pushes him in the direction of thinking that maybe he really is telling the truth. "Who framed me, then?" Randy asks, kind of rhetorically. He was just in the middle of doing some pretty cool C++ coding when he got yanked out of his cell to have this surprise encounter with the dentist, and is surprising himself with just how bored and irritated he is. He has reverted, in other words, back into a pure balls-to-the-wall nerdism, rivaled only by his early game coding days back in Seattle. The sheer depth and involution of the current nerdism binge would be hard to convey to anyone. Intellectually, he is juggling half a dozen lit torches, Ming vases, live puppies, and running chainsaws. In this frame of mind, he cannot bring himself to give a shit about the fact that this incredibly powerful billionaire has gone to a lot of trouble to come and F2F with him. And so he asks the question as nothing more than a perfunctory gesture, the subtext being, "I wish you'd go away, but minimal standards of social decency dictate that I should say something." The dentist, no slouch himself in the social ineptness department, comes right back as if it were an actual request for information. "I can only assume that you have somehow gotten embroiled with someone who has a lot of influence in this country. It appears that someone is trying to send you a..."
"No, just stop," Randy says. "Don't say it."
Hubert Kepler is now looking at him quizzically, so Randy continues, "The message theory doesn't hold up." Kepler looks genuinely baffled for a few moments, then actually does grin a little bit.
"Well, it certainly isn't an attempt to do away with you because..."
"Obviously," Randy says.
"Yes, obviously."
There is another one of those long pauses. Kepler seems unsure of himself. Randy arches his back and stretches.
"The chair in my cell is not what you call ergonomic," he says.
He holds his arms out and wiggles the fingers.
"My carpals are going to start acting up again. I can tell."
Randy is looking at Kepler pretty carefully when he says this, and there's no doubt that genuine astonishment is now spreading across the dentist's face. The dentist only has one facial expression, already described, but it changes in intensity. It gets more so and less so depending on his emotions. The dentist's expression proves he had no idea until now that Randy's been allowed to have a computer in his cell. In the trying-to-figure-out-what-the-fuck-is-going-on department, the computer is the single most important datum, and Kepler didn't even know about it until just now. So to whatever extent the dentist actually gives a shit, he has a lot of thinking to do. He excuses himself pretty soon after. Not half an hour later, some 25-year-old American guy with a ponytail shows up and has a brief audience with Randy. It turns out that he works for Chester in Seattle, and has just now flown across the Pacific on Chester's personal jet and came here straight from the airport. He is completely jazzed, totally in bat-out-of-hell mode, and cannot shut up. The sheer amazingness of his sudden flight across the ocean on a rich guy's private jet has made a really, really deep impression on him, and he obviously needs someone to share it with. He has brought a care package consisting of some junk food, a few trashy novels, the largest bottle of Pepto-Bismol Randy's ever seen, a CD Walkman, and a cubicle stack of CDs. This guy can't get over the battery thing. He was told to bring a lot of extra batteries, and so he did, and sure enough, between the luggage guys at the airport and the customs inspectors, All of the batteries disappeared en route except for one package that he's got in the pocket of his long, baggy Seattle Grunge Boy shorts. Seattle's full of guys like this who flipped a coin when they graduated from college, heads Prague, tails Seattle, and just showed up with this expectation that because they were young and smart, they'd find a job and begin making money and then, appallingly enough, did exactly that. Randy can't figure out what the world must look like to a guy like this. He has a hard time getting rid of the guy who shares the common assumption, increasingly annoying, that just because Randy's in jail he doesn't have a life, has nothing better to do than interface with visitors. When Randy gets back to his cell, he sits cross-legged on his bed with a Walkman and begins dealing out the CDs like cards in a solitaire game. The selection is pretty reasonable. A two-disc set of the Brandenburg Concertos, a collection of Bach organ fugues, nerds have a thing about Bach, some Louis Armstrong, some Wynton Marsalis, and then various selections from Hammerdown Systems, which is a Seattle-based record label in which Chester is a major investor. It is a second-generation Seattle scene record label. All of its artists are young people who came to Seattle after they graduated from college in search of the legendary Seattle music scene and discovered that it didn't really exist. It was just a couple of dozen guys who sat around playing guitar in one another's basements, and so who were basically forced to choose between going home in ignominy or fabricating the Seattle music scene of their imagination from whole cloth. This led to the establishment of any number of small clubs and the foundation of many bands that were not rooted in any kind of authentic reality whatsoever, but merely reflected the dreams and aspiration of pan-global young adults who had all flocked to Seattle on the same chimera hunt. This second-wave scene came in for a lot of abuse from those of the original two dozen people who had not yet died of drug overdose or suicide. There was something of a backlash. And yet, about 36 hours after the backlash reached its maximum intensity, there was an anti-backlash backlash from young immigrants who asserted their right to some kind of unique cultural identity as people who had naively come to Seattle and discovered that there was no there there and that they would have to create it themselves. Fueled by that conviction and by their own youthful libidinous energy, and by a few cultural commentators who found this whole scenario fetchingly postmodern, they started a whole lot of second-generation bands and even a couple of record labels, of which Hammerdown Systems is the only one that didn't either go out of business or get turned into a wholly owned subsidiary of an L.A. or New York-based major label inside of 6 months. And so Chester has decided to favor Randy with those recent Hammerdown selections of which he is most proud. Perversely, almost all of these are from bands that are not even in Seattle at all, but in small, prohibitively hip college towns in North Carolina and the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. But Randy does find one from an evidently Seattle-based band called Shekandar. Evidently, that is, because on the back of the CD is a blurry photograph of several band members drinking 16-ounce lattes in cups bearing the logo of a chain of coffee bars that, as far as Randy knows, has not yet burst free from the city limits of Seattle to crush everything in its path worldwide in the now wearisomely predictable manner of Seattle-based companies. Now, Shekandar happens to have been the name of an especially foul underworld deity who played an important role in some of the game scenarios that Randy played with Avi and Chester and the gang back in the old days. Randy opens up the case of the CD and notes immediately that the disc has the golden hue of a master, not the traditional silver of a mere copy. Randy puts that golden master into his Walkman and hits the play button and is treated to some passable post-Cobain mortem material, genetically engineered to have nothing in common with what is traditionally thought of as the Seattle sound, and in that sense absolutely typical of Seattle du jour. He jumps forward through a couple more tracks and then rips the earphones off his head, cursing as the Walkman attempts to translate a stream of pure digital information representing something other than music into sound. This feels a bit like needles of dry ice jabbed into his eardrums. Randy moves the golden disc to the CD-ROM drive that is built into his laptop and checks it out. Indeed, it does sport a couple of audio tracks, as he's discovered, but almost all of the disc's capacity is given over to computer files. There are several directories or folders, each named after one of the documents that was in Grandfather's trunk. Within each of these directories is a long list of files named page.001.jpg, page.002.jpg, and so on. Randy starts opening them up, using the same net browser software that he uses to read the Cryptonomicon, and discovers that they are all scanned image files. Evidently, Chester had a bunch of minions destaple those documents and feed them page by page through a scanner. At the same time, he must have had graphic artists, presumably people he knows through Hammerdown Systems, hastily whipping up this fake Shekhandar album cover. It's even got a package insert, photographs of Shekhandar in concert. What it really is a parody of the post-Seattle scene, Seattle scene, that aligns perfectly with the faulty notions of same that could be expected in the imagination of a Philippine airport customs inspector, who, like everyone else, is fantasizing about moving to Seattle. The lead guitarist looks kind of like Chester in a wig. All of this sneaky stuff is probably gratuitous. It probably would have been okay for Chester to just FedEx the fucking document straight to the jail, but Chester, sitting in his house by Lake Washington, is working on a set of assumptions about Manila just as faulty as what half of the world believes about Seattle. At least Randy gets a laugh out of it before diving into Zeta functions. A word about libido. It's been something like 3 weeks for Randy now. He was just beginning to address this situation when a highly intelligent and perceptive Catholic ex-priest was suddenly introduced into the cell next to his and began sleeping 6 inches away from him. Since then, masturbation per se has been pretty much out of the question. To the extent Randy believes in any god at all, he's been praying for a nocturnal emission. His prostate gland now has the size and consistency of a croquet ball. He feels it all the time and has begun to think of it as his hunk of burning love. Randy had a spot of prostate trouble once when he was chronically drinking too much coffee and it made everything between his nipples and his knees hurt. The urologist explained that little man Tate is neurologically wired into just about every other part of your body, and he didn't have to exert any rhetorical skill or marshal any detailed arguments in order to make Randy believe that. Randy has believed ever since that the ability of men to become moronically obsessed with copulation is in some way a reflection of this wiring diagram. When you are ready to give the external world the benefit of your genetic material, that is, when the Tate is fully loaded, even your pinkies and eyelids know about it. And so it might be expected that Randy would be thinking all the time about America Shafto, his sexual target of choice, who, just to make things a lot worse, has probably been spending a lot of time in wetsuits lately. And indeed, that is where his thoughts were directed at the moment Enoch Root was dragged in. But since then, it has become evident that he needs to exercise some kind of iron mental discipline here and not think about Amy at all. Whilst juggling all of those chainsaws and puppies, he is also walking a sort of intellectual tightrope, with decryption of the Arethusa intercepts at the end of that tightrope, and as long as he keeps his eyes fixed on that goal and just keeps putting one foot in front of the other, he'll get there. Amy in a wetsuit is down below somewhere, no doubt trying to be emotionally supportive, but if he even glances in her direction, he's a goner. What he's reading here is a set of academic papers, dating to the 1930s and early 40s, that have been heavily marked up by his grandfather, who went through them, none too subtly gleaning anything that could be useful on the cryptographic front. That it's none too subtle is a good thing for Randy, whose grasp of pure number theory is just barely adequate here. Chester's minions had to scan not only the fronts of these pages, but the backs too, which were originally blank, but on which Grandpa wrote many notes. For example, there is a paper written by Alan Turing in 1937 in which Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse has found some kind of error, or at least something that Turing didn't go into in sufficient detail, forcing him to cover several pages with annotations. Randy's blood absolutely runs cold at the very idea that he is being so presumptuous as to participate in such a colloquy. When he realizes just how deep over his head he is intellectually, he turns off his computer and goes to bed and sleeps the bootless sleep of the depressed for 10 hours. Eventually, he convinces himself that most of the junk in these papers probably has no direct relevance to Arethusa, and that he just needs to calm down and filter the material carefully. 2 weeks pass. His prayers, vis-a-vis the hunk of burning love, are answered, giving him at least a couple of days of relief during which he can admit the concept of Amy Shafto into his awareness, but only in a really austere and passionless way. Attorney Alejandro shows up occasionally to tell Randy that things are not going very well. Surprising obstacles have arisen. All of the people he was planning to bribe have been preemptively counter-bribed by someone. These meetings are tedious for Randy, who thinks he has figured everything out. To begin with, it's Wing and not the dentist who has caused all of this, and so Attorney Alejandro's working on faulty assumptions. Enoch, when he called Randy on the plane, said his old NSA buddy was working for one of the Crips' clients. It seems clear now that this client is Wing. Consequently, Wing knows that Randy has Arethusa. Wing believes that the Arethusa intercepts contain information about the location of the primary. He wants Randy to decrypt those messages so that he'll know where to dig. Hence, the whole setup with the laptop. All of Attorney Alejandro's efforts to spring Randy loose will be unavailing until Wing has the information that he wants, or thinks he does. Then, all of a sudden, the ice will break, and Randy will unexpectedly be cut loose on a technicality. Randy's so sure of this that he finds Attorney Alejandro's visits annoying. He would like to explain all of this so that Attorney Alejandro could knock it off with the wild goose chase, and his increasingly bleak and dull situation reports on same. But then Wing, who presumably surveils these attorney-client conferences, would know that Randy had figured out the whole game, and Randy doesn't want Wing to know that. So he nods through these meetings with his lawyer, and then, for good measure, goes back and tries to sound convincingly bewildered and depressed as he gives Enoch Root the update. He gets to the point, conceptually, where his grandfather was when he commenced breaking the Arethusa messages. That is, he has a theory in mind now of how Arethusa worked. If he doesn't know the exact algorithm, he knows what family of algorithms it belongs to, and that gives him a search space with many fewer dimensions than he had before. Certainly few enough for a modern computer to explore. He goes on a 48-hour hacking binge. The nerve damage in his wrists has mounted to the point where he practically has sparks shooting out of his fingertips. His doctor told him never again to work on these non-ergonomic keyboards. His eyes start to go out on him, too, and he has to invert the screen colors and work with white letters on a black background, gradually increasing the size of the letters as he loses the ability to focus. But at last, he gets something that he thinks is going to work, and he fires it up and sets it to running on the Arethusa intercepts, which live inside the computer's memory but have never yet been displayed upon its screen. He falls asleep. When he wakes up, the computer is informing him that he's got a probable break into one of the messages. Actually, three of them. All intercepted on 4 April 1945, and hence all encrypted using the same keystream. Unlike human codebreakers, computers can't read English. They can't even recognize it. They can crank out possible decrypts of a message at tremendous speed, but given two character strings like "send help immediately" and "XUEBP TOAFFNMQPT, they have no inherent ability to recognize the first as a successful decryption of a message and the second as a failure. But they can do a frequency count on the letters. If the computer finds that E is the most common, followed by T, and so on and so forth, then it's a pretty strong indication that the text is some natural human language and not just random gibberish. By using this and other slightly more sophisticated tests, Randy's come up with a routine that should be pretty good at recognizing success. And it's telling him this morning that 4 April 1945 is broken. Randy dare not display the decrypted messages on screen for fear that they contain the information that Wing's looking for, and so he cannot actually read these messages as desperately as he'd like to. But by using a command called grep, which searches through text files without opening them, he can at least verify that the word Manila occurs in two places. Based on this break, with several more days' work, Randy solves Arethusa entirely. He comes up, in other words, with A times X equals K, such that for any given date X, he can figure out what K, the keystream for that day, would be. And just to prove it, he has the computer crank out K for every day in 1944 and 1945 and then use them to decrypt the Arethusa intercepts that came in on those days, without displaying them, and does the frequency count on them and verifies that it worked in each case. So now he has decrypted all of the messages, but he cannot actually read them without transmitting their contents to Wing. And so now the subliminal channel comes into play. In cryptospeak, a subliminal channel is a trick whereby secret information is subtly embedded in a stream of other stuff. Usually it means something like manipulating the least significant bits of an image file to convey a text message. Randy's drawn inspiration from the concept in his labors here in jail. Yes, he has been working on decrypting Arethusa, and that has involved screwing around with a tremendous number of files and writing a lot of code. The number of separate files he's read, created, and edited in the last few weeks is probably in the thousands. None of them have had title bars on their windows, and so the Van Eck freaker surveilling him have presumably had a terrible time keeping track of which is which. Randy can open a file by typing its title in a window and hitting the return key, all of which happens so fast that the surveillance people probably don't have time to read or understand what he has typed before it disappears. This, he thinks, may have given him just a bit of leeway. He has kept a subliminal channel going in the background, working on a few other bits of code that have nothing to do with breaking Arethusa. He got the idea for one of these when he was paging through the Cryptonomicon and discovered an appendix that contained a listing of the Morse code. Randy knew Morse code when he was a Boy Scout and learned it again a few years ago when he was studying for a ham radio license, and it doesn't take him long to refresh his memory. And neither does it take him very long to write a little bit of code that turns his computer's spacebar into a Morse code key so that he can talk to the machine by whacking out dots and dashes with his thumb. This might look a little conspicuous, if not for the fact that Randy spends half of his time reading text files in little windows on the screen, and the way you page through a text file in most Unix systems is by whacking the spacebar. All he has to do is whack it in a particular rhythm, a detail he's relying on the surveillance guys to miss. The results all go into a buffer that is never displayed on the screen and get written out to files with completely meaningless names. So, for example, Randy can whack out the following rhythm on his spacebar while pretending to read a lengthy section of the Cryptonomicon. Dash, dot, 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 pause, dot, dot, dash, dot, pause, dot, pause, dash, pause, dash, which ought to spell out boondock. He doesn't want to open the resulting file on screen, but later, while he's in the middle of a long series of other cryptic commands, he can type grep ndo, meaningless file name, is greater than another meaningless file name, and grep will search through the first named file to see if it contains the string ndo and put the results into the second named file, which he can then check quite a bit later. He can also do grep bun and grep dok. And if the results of all those greps are true, then he can be pretty confident that he has successfully coded the sequence boondock into that one file. In the same way, he can code coordinates into some other file and latitude into another, and various numbers into others. And finally, by using another command called cat, he can slowly combine these one-word files into longer ones. All of these demands the same ridiculous patience as, say, tunneling out of a prison with a teaspoon or sawing through iron bars with a nail file. But there comes a point, after he's spent about a month in jail, when suddenly he's able to make a window appear on the screen that contains the following message. Coordinates of primary storage locations. Site, boondock. Latitude, north, 14 degrees, 32 minutes. Longitude, east, 120 degrees, 56 minutes. Site, Makati, etc. Site, El Dorado, etc. All of which is total bullshit that he just made up. The coordinates given for the Makati site are those of a luxury hotel in Manila, sited at a major intersection that used to be the site of a Nipponese military airbase. Randy happens to have these numbers in his computer because he took them down during his very early days in Manila, when he was doing the GPS survey work for siting Epiphyte's antennas. The coordinates given for site El Dorado are simply the location of the pile of gold bars that he and Doug Shafto went to examine, plus a small random error factor. and those given for Site Bundok are the real coordinates of Golgotha, plus a couple of random error factors that should have Wing digging a deep hole in the ground about 20 kilometers away from the real site. How does Randy know that there is a site called Golgotha, and how does he know its real coordinates? His computer told him using Morse code. Computer keyboards have LEDs on them that are essentially kind of useless. One to tell you when NUM lock is on, one for caps lock, and a third one whose purpose Randy can't even remember. And for no reason other than the general belief that every aspect of a computer should be under the control of hackers, someone, somewhere, wrote some library routine called XLEDs that make it possible for programmers to turn these things on and off at will. And for a month, Randy's been writing a little program that makes use of these routines to output the contents of a text file in Morse code by flashing one of those LEDs. And while all kinds of useless crap has been scrolling across the screen of his computer as camouflage, Randy's been hunched over, gazing into the subliminal channel of that blinking LED, reading the contents of the decrypted Arethusa intercepts, one of which says, "The primary is codenamed Golgotha. Coordinates of the main drift are as follows. Latitude north, etc." The Basement. At this point in history, April of 1945, the word that denotes a person who sits and performs arithmetical calculations is computer. Waterhouse has just found a whole room full of dead computers. Anyone in his right mind, anyone other than Waterhouse and some of his odd Bletchley Park friends like Turing, would have taken one look at these computers and assumed that they were the accounting department or something, and that each slave in the room was independently toting up figures. Waterhouse really ought to remain open to this idea because it is so obvious. But from the very beginning he has had a hypothesis of his own, much more interesting and peculiar. It is that slaves were functioning collectively as cogs in a larger computation machine, each performing a small portion of a complex calculation, receiving numbers from one computer, doing some arithmetic, producing new numbers, passing them on to another computer. Central Bureau is able to trace the identities of five of the dead slaves. They came from places like Saigon, Singapore, Manila, and Java, but they had in common that they were ethnic Chinese, and they were shopkeepers. Apparently, the Nipponese had cast a wide net for expert abacus users and brought them together from all over the co-prosperity sphere to this island in Manila Bay. Lawrence Waterhouse tracks down a computer of his own in the ruins of Manila, a Mr. Gu, whose small import-export business was destroyed by the war. It is hard to run such a business when you are on an island and every ship that leaves or approaches the island gets sunk by Americans. Waterhouse shows Mr. Gu photos of the abacai as they were left by the dead computers. Mr. Gu tells him what numbers are encoded in those bead positions, as well as giving Waterhouse a couple of days' tutorial on basic abacus technique. The important thing learned from this is not really abacus skills, but rather the remarkable speed and precision with which a computer like Mr. Gu can churn out calculations. At this point, Waterhouse has reduced the problem to pure data. About half of it's in his memory and the other half scattered around on his desk. The data includes all of the scratch paper left behind by the computers. To match up the numbers on the scratch paper with the numbers left on the abacai and thus to compile a flash-frozen image of the calculations that were underway in that room when the apocalypse struck is not that difficult, at least by the standards of difficulty that apply during wartime when, for example, landing several thousand men and tons of equipment on a remote island and taking it from heavily armed, suicidal Japanese troops with the loss of only a few dozen lives is considered to be easy. From this, it is possible, although it approaches being difficult, to generalize and to figure out the underlying mathematical algorithm that generated the numbers on the abacai. Waterhouse becomes familiar with some of the computer's handwriting and develops evidence that slips of scratch paper were being handed from one computer to another, and then to yet another. Some of the computers had logarithm tables at their stations, which is a really important clue as to what they were doing. In this way, he is able to draw up a map of the room with each computer's station identified by number and a web of arrows interconnecting the stations, depicting the flow of paper and of data. This helps him visualize the collective calculation as a whole and to reconstruct what was going on in that subterranean chamber. For weeks it comes in bits and pieces, and then one evening, some switch turns on in Lawrence Waterhouse's mind, and he knows in some preconscious way that he's about to get it. He works for 24 hours. By that point, he has come up with a lot of evidence to support, and none to contradict, the hypothesis that this calculation is a variant of a zeta function. He naps for 6 hours, gets up and works for another 30. By that point, he's figured out that it definitely is some kind of zeta function, and he's managed to figure out several of its constants and terms. He almost has it now. He sleeps for 12 hours, gets up and walks around Manila to clear his head, goes back to work, and hammers away at it for 36 hours. This is the fun part, when big slabs of the puzzle, painstakingly assembled from fragments, suddenly begin to lock together, and the whole thing begins to make sense. It all comes down to an equation written down on one sheet of paper. Just looking at it makes him feel weirdly nostalgic, because it's the same type of equation he used to work with back at Princeton with Alan and Rudy. Another pause for sleep then, because he has to be alert to do the final thing. The final thing is as follows. He goes into the basement of a building in Manila. The building has been turned into a signals intelligence headquarters by the United States Army. He is one of some half dozen people on the face of the planet who are allowed to enter this particular room. The room amounts to a bit more than a quarter of the basement's total square footage, and in fact, shares the basement with several other rooms, some of which are larger than it is, and some of which are serving as offices for men with higher rank than Waterhouse wears on his uniform. But there are a few oddities connected with Waterhouse's room. One, at any given moment, no fewer than 3 United States Marines are loitering directly in front of the door of this room, carrying pump shotguns and other weapons optimized for close-range indoor flesh shredding. Two, lots of power cables go into this room. It has its own fuse panel, separate from the rest of the building's electrical system. 3. The room emits muffled yet deafening quasi-musical sounds. 4. The room is referred to as the basement, even though it's only part of the basement. When the basement is written down, it is capitalized. When someone, let's say Lieutenant Colonel Earl Comstock, is going to verbalize this, he will come to a complete stop in mid-sentence, so that all of the preceding words kind of pile into each other like cars in a colliding train. He will, in fact, bracket the basement between a pair of full 1-second-long caesuras. During the first of these, he will raise his eyebrows and purse his lips simultaneously, altering the entire aspect ratio of his face so that it becomes strikingly elongated in the vertical dimension, and his eyes will dart sideways in case any Nipponese spies somehow managed to escape the recent apocalypse and found a place to lurk around the fringes of his peripheral vision. Then he will say the, and then he will say basement, drawing out the S and primly articulating the T. And then will come another caesura, during which he will incline his head towards the listener and fix him with a sober, appraising look, seeming to demand some kind of verbal or gestural acknowledgement from the listener that something appallingly significant has just passed between them. And then he will continue with whatever he was saying. Waterhouse nods to the Marines, one of whom hauls the door open for him. A really funny thing happened shortly after the basement was established, when it was still just a bunch of wooden crates and a stack of 32-foot-long sewer pipe segments, and the electricians were still running in the power lines. Lieutenant Colonel Earl Comstock tried to enter the basement to inspect it, but owing to a clerical error, Lieutenant Colonel Earl Comstock's name was not on the list, and so a difference of opinion ensued that culminated with one of the Marines drawing his Colt 45 and taking the safety off and chambering around, pressing the barrel of the weapon directly into the center of Comstock's right thigh, and then reminiscing about some of the spectacular femur-bursting wounds he had personally witnessed on places like Tarawa, and in general trying to help Comstock visualize just what his life would be like, both short and long term, if a large piece of lead were to pass through the middle of said major bone. To everyone's surprise, Comstock was delighted with this encounter, almost enchanted, and hasn't stopped talking about it since. Of course, now his name's on the list. The basement is filled with ETC card machines and with several stacks of equipment devoid of corporate logos, inasmuch as they were designed and largely built by Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse in Brisbane. When all of these things are hooked together in just the right way, they constitute a digital computer. Like a pipe organ, a digital computer is not so much a machine as a meta-machine that can be made into any of a number of different machines by changing its internal configuration. At the moment, Lawrence Pritchard Waterhouse is the only guy in the world who understands the digital computer well enough to actually do this, though he's training a couple of Comstock's ETC men to do it themselves. On the day in question, he is turning the digital computer into a machine for calculating the zeta function that he thinks is at the core of the cryptosystem called Azure or Pufferfish.